It is not like an achievement to raise money. Like, it is a responsibility to be a good steward of that capital. And that's pressure. And that's pressure on you. And so if you get the chance to just figure things out and give yourself space and time, that is valid. And we should celebrate that more. Like, taking time to really understand your customer before just starting that clock.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome to the latest episode of Upwards, talking about startups, tech, and leadership culture. Welcome to the show. Today, I have a special guest, Jenny Biesing, with me. Jenny is an entrepreneur and co-founder of Excellent, an employee experience design company. Jenny has spent her career consulting private and public companies on growth in New Zealand, Australia, and the US. Jenny originates from Texas. Welcome. Howdy.
Howdy.
Very nice to have you on the show. Sorry, I had to get that in there. And we're actually in Texas, which is pretty special. So this is why we're doing this in person. Really excited to be here and listen to what Jenny has to say. Today, we are going to talk about entrepreneurship. We're going to talk about startups. We're going to talk about Jenny's background and a little bit of how she got into entrepreneurship. We're going to talk about four myths that she's identified that often people kind of buy into, and how we need to overcome those by thinking a little bit more counterintuitively than we might otherwise do. So welcome again.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm excited to have this conversation in Austin.
Indeed. It's very, very cool to be here, by the way. We've had a great time. I've been here for a couple of weeks in the US, but the scene here is very real. It's huge. There's a lot going on. A very special episode of Upwards from Austin in Texas. All right, let's kick into it.
Let's do it.
Jenny, tell us all about you. Tell us about your background.
Yeah, well, I actually grew up dancing and was a dance major in college and was a professional dancer, which is a really funny way to get into entrepreneurship.
Right, right.
And my first business was a yoga and Pilates studio. And I learned a lot about how you bring a company from not existing to kind of creating community. And I learned that there's really sort of no good way to do that except through hard work and person to person, one at a time, unscalable things. So I learned about that. Then I got into ed tech, specifically on physical education. So it was a good foray in using my skills, but then learning what a tech content platform would look like and how you produce that and how you organize it. And then spent 4 years doing marketplace software and learned a lot about platform strategy, marketplaces, initial liquidity. Like, what's really important is not the idea, because I've heard 5,000 marketplace ideas. It's really about how do you get to something that can go. And there's just like all of these pre-steps that we don't really think about. And also about iterative building and getting feedback, because everybody wants to build a Ferrari and that's not always what your users need. So then recently I joined a company called Excellent. Sam Gadd is my co-founder, and we are working on really people and organizational strategy using employee experience design, which is a lot like any other type of, you know, user experience design, customer experience, really treating the employee experience the same way with design thinking.
That's a fascinating way to get into a very kind of technically focused entrepreneurial startup coming from a dance background. That's fascinating. And I think I often see this with a lot of people that come in from very different sort of backgrounds. I think it's kind of like an advantage, because you have a very different way of thinking and you can bring, you know, non-traditional thinking into the startup world, which sometimes people lack. And so I think it can be a real superpower.
Yeah, I mean, I've found it to be challenging. I always know the least, which means that I have to ask the most questions, which is really helpful in uncovering what's actually at play. So yeah, definitely it's sometimes it doesn't feel like a superpower, but it does feel like I am able to bring something that not everybody in the room would, because they all have a shared understanding.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. And so that's taken you from dance. You've done a lot of work in startup land. You've been around the scene for a while. What have you seen in your travels in terms of kind of some of these myths that you know perpetuate often startup founders buy into? You know, you've seen enough people to kind of see those patterns play out. Can you tell us a little bit more about those?
Yeah, I got really interested in consulting because I love systems and I love patterns, and have just spent really I've spent about the last 10 years consulting into startups. And I think specifically where I do my best work is with technical companies, because typically they've thought really deeply about maybe the problem they're trying to solve or the product, but haven't necessarily thought about what their channel to market is going to be, how they're going to engage with their customers, how they're going to create community, and how they're going to grow. And so I find that if I can find, you know, companies at that stage where they're ready to, normally it's after they have done one of these things that we'll talk about. If I find them right about that time, they're like, okay, we thought this and that didn't work. Can you help us? And the answer is yes. But I think it would be ideal if maybe we just kind of skipped over the messing it up part.
Right. Yeah. Right. I think we, you know, as a technical founder myself, I see quite a few other technical founders, really starting with a solution and starting with the code, and they just start making something and they bring it into the world. And it's like, look at this shiny thing I've made, and it's amazing. Yeah. And then they have this discovery that they actually need to sell it.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, they could do it would benefit a lot if they started well before that process. Mm-hmm. I've just seen this pattern play out over and over and over again, which I'm sure you have as well.
Yeah. And then doing it backwards is just a little harder. If you've already produced it, then, you know, you have kind of like some constraints. But I think as soon as you start thinking about it through this lens, solutions become apparent. So yeah, we can kick into it if you want.
Yeah. All right. Let's cover what's myth number one.
I think that the first thing that always happens when I talk to especially early stage startups, or maybe a startup that has like a strategy that's based around like, we're going to launch a new feature, product, thing, initiative, podcast, we're going to launch. And that is going to be, and that's going to cause all of these things. And anytime I'm sitting with somebody and I say, okay, so what is your go-to-market? What is your strategy? Well, first we're going to do a launch. And I have seen so many launches where actually nearly nothing changes, even with people with huge audiences, even with companies that are totally established. Like, a launch is something that you want to tell people. That's not necessarily something that people need.
Right. So it's almost more for you than
it is for you.
It's more for you than your customer.
We're going to do PR. We're going to do a LinkedIn post. We're going to we. And it's nothing about the customer. And so anytime I know that a launch is like a central theme of a growth strategy, it isn't that a launch can't do that, but it's how you relate to that. Like, how are you involving your customers? How are you involving your community? What do they want? What would they be excited about? Like, I think we know a lot of companies that do this well, and it is by design. And so that is my number one red flag if I'm talking to a founder. And a launch is going to be like the start of money just like flowing in. Like, how are we even going to, you know, how are we going to manage our Stripe account with all this money?
Yeah. Where are we going to put all that money?
Where are we going to put it? Yeah. Yeah. So that's kind of the first one. I mean, thinking about launches as not about you, but rather the opportunity to engage your audience in something that they want or need is a new way to think about it. Not just we're going to pump it out to the world and see what happens, because that's exactly what happens. You'll get a ton of engagement on that post or on that day, and then nothing else happens because there is no plan. There's no strategy for like, okay, and then in the second day, or how are we making this a long-term, how can this have a long tail? It's just a event. And that is like a huge red flag. And that seems counterintuitive because you think like, oh, well, a product launch, when Apple does it, like they make a ton of money. But there's a lot of specific things that they do. And so that's at a high level. Anytime you say we're going to launch something and you think it's going to make a big difference, imagine also a world in which it makes no difference.
Right, right.
Which is crazy.
And you know, to your point with the Apple example, like they, you know, do the big keynotes and it's the big launch, but then they send you emails and then they run advertising and then you see people with the product.
It's leading like
a very,
up to
very
it.
Sophisticated strategy. It's not just a keynote.
It is not an event. It is an entire strategy prior, you know, all of that. And it has to bring in the whole ecosystem of that you are a part of. So yes, to your point, that's exactly what I'm talking about. Yep.
Great. That's a really good lesson. So don't blow all of your budget on the launch. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe still do it, but think about the follow on, think about the follow through and involve your customers. Mm-hmm. Don't do it to them, do it with them.
Yes. And that's co-design, which is a lot of what we do at Excellent. And the funny thing about co-design, which is how you approach user experience or anything else. And what I find so funny, I'm like, wait, so you guys design your whole product with UX, but then you don't apply that to sales and marketing. Why not? You know,
that's a really good question.
Like, why aren't you co-designing these things with your customers?
You know, I'm from a UX background, and coming into sales, it's like, why do we just do things to customers? You know, why do we just not, you know, we're talking to them lots, so maybe it feels like we're getting feedback, but really the process is not particularly innovative. Sometimes it's just following playbooks and following patterns. So, you know, taking some of those principles into play and putting them in different parts of the business, I think can be hugely effective.
Yeah. For sure. I think you're touching on sort of the second one that I like to talk about, which is the sales myth. This is another one that is, it's so common. So I think the big thing that you, if you do this, if you feel like she's talking to me, I feel attacked. So many people do. This is like the common way to approach it. But with sales, when I'm talking to a founder, and typically it will be a technical founder, but not always, really all founders, I'll say, what is your strategy for sales? And they'll say something to the effect of, well, first, I'm going to hire a really good salesperson. Or if they want to really mess it up and really blow a lot of money, they'll say, I'm going to hire a really awesome sales leader or manager. And I'll say, oh, great. What is your sales process? And they'll be like, well, I mean, that's what they're going to figure out. That's what I'm going to pay them for. And then I say, what is your conversion rate from this step to this step? And they'll say, you know, I don't think I've ever even looked or no. And what that tells me is that basically, especially at early stages, basically until the point at which the founder or a couple of key people in your organization have a lot of predictability around the way that you do it, it is not time to hire someone else.
Right.
But everyone thinks the silver bullet in sales is getting someone who knows about sales. But sales is actually about knowing the customer and knowing their problem and being able to translate that. And in fact, I always say that the best person for that in the beginning is the founder and maybe a couple other key people in the organization to see if you can replicate it. Like, if you have somebody in the organization that's like, I know you don't do sales, neither do I, but I do it this way. Let's see if you also do it this way, if it works. Okay, now we have a process. Now we can hire a couple of people to execute this process. And so hiring a salesperson to figure out how to sell your product to customers they don't know is a really slow burn way to blow a lot of money. So it really, founders need to feel like it is actually my job to figure out if, because market product fit is actually the rubber meets the road in the sales process. Everyone can make a sale. Founders can do it really easily. And so the point isn't to see if the founder can sell. You can sell. Sometimes you'll sell because they're just like, we know that Phil is awesome and we want whatever he builds. But if you can't replicate what you do to get there, it's really hard. And you will just sort of like constantly feel like, why is this the hardest problem in the world? And to your point, I think if technical founders applied design thinking to sales, all of a sudden you have a framework you're familiar with, applying it to something that is exactly the same. You're trying to figure out what these people, you're trying to solve a problem, and you just need to apply the same framework to sales.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. And I think the founder is just the best person to do that. You have the, you know, you have the energy, you have the motivation, you have the knowledge, quite frankly, of the market, hopefully, the product, everything.
What you're
about
trying
it,
to do.
What you're trying to do, and the charisma, because you know you're the founder. And like you say, if you can't do it as a founder, then
you can't do it.
The salesperson's just not going to be able to do it either. So that's a really, really good point. I think absolutely get founder-led sales. Like, I'm not a sales, I didn't start as a salesperson at all. But one of the best things I ever did personally was learn to follow a sales process, right? And to talk to customers and to establish a process that can be repeated.
Yeah. And I know that technical founders have all of, you need to document it. You need to, you know, like, you guys have all the skills. It's just not thinking of it as any different than what you do behind the scenes. And I actually think you're a great salesperson. So.
Oh, thank you. No, thank you. I'll take it. I'll take the credit.
Yeah.
No, that's, that, I mean, that is a really, really good point. So if you're a founder, if you're a technical founder, especially, learn to sell. mm-hmm. and follow a process. And it's mostly process driven. So technical founders are really good at process, mm-hmm. As it happens. So, you know, we can follow a process, we can be methodical about it, we can test and experiment, which are all parts of things that we do in dev land and technical land and product land. And it turns out you can apply that to sales as well.
Completely. Yeah. And I think sales is such a funny word, because people say, I'm not good at sales, or I don't know how to do sales, or I don't like sales. And I think it's just like a word that is dirty. I think, you know, yeah. Alex McNaughton at Apprentice says that, like, sales is a dirty word. But when you don't relate to it that way, and you relate to it as, this is market research, this is, you know, what am I good at that I can apply to what we need to, in order to engage with our market and solve people's problems, it starts to get better. So I think just stop thinking of it as sales, because that's like kind of like a wall that people hit. But you've like completely gracefully blown through that. So that's great.
Great. All right. All right. Myth number three.
Yeah. Fundraising.
Funding.
These meetings are very short, because these red flags are just like flying everywhere, right? So I'll say, what is your strategy? And they say, well, so first what we're going to do is we are going to raise $1 million. And I'll say, awesome. Why $1 million? And it's like, so we have $1 million to spend. And it's like, well, yeah, that's great. But I have, in most of my career, bootstrapped companies.
Right.
And I've had the privilege of being in a company that had excellent market product fit, as such that the product was so early, not what we wanted it to be, not, you know, but people were like, we need it, just ripping it out of our hands. I think somebody said that before, like, it just feels like they're ripping it out of your hands and you don't even feel like it's ready. And I think anybody who hasn't experienced that doesn't then know that they are not in that place.
Right.
You know, and so I feel really privileged to have been in this company where we're like, I mean, the product is what it is, but like they just want it, and they want it yesterday. That is a feeling that anything that's not that, it's just not, you just haven't figured it out yet. And so giving away a lot of your company before you figure that out, to me, is a bad idea, because basically what it does is it puts you on a clock timer to figure it out. And sometimes the factor is time. And sometimes the factor is, you know, it's just not the right thing, or you need to pivot. And sometimes when you raise money, you feel very much like we have to do this thing we promised in this amount of time. And the market doesn't move at your pace. The market moves at the market's pace. The customer needs what they need when they need it. And so I think the timing of taking investment, which is absolutely incredible at the right time, if you take it before, it is like so much pressure that's really unnecessary. And so I always just really try to work with founders on, why do you think it's the money you need? And a lot of times I think we get to the very bottom of it. And this is like just between you and me and everybody watching.
And everybody here. Yeah.
At the bottom of it, it really is like that they don't want to work on the customer. They don't want to like go engage with the customer. They don't, even in the smallest, tiniest ways.
Right.
To do the work of being with the customer or hearing the real feedback, you know, but there is really no other way. Like you can spend no money on that, or you can spend $1 million on that, but you have to do that at some point. And so being really strategic about when you raise money and why you raise money, because we all say, we've figured out three things and now we just need fuel on the fire. And it's like, that is actually true in a lot of scenarios, and in many, many, many others, it is not. And being honest with yourself about that is huge. It is not like an achievement to raise money. Like, it is a responsibility to be a good Yep. steward of that capital. And that's pressure. And that's pressure on you. And so if you get the chance to just figure things out and give yourself space and time, that is valid. And we should celebrate that more. Like taking time to really understand your customer before just starting that clock.
It's like go slow before you go fast.
Yeah.
Right. Walk before you can run. You can't. Another way, I think what you're saying is that you can't just pour money into no product market fit and expect it to work.
You can't
oversell the market. You can't just pour ads. Like, you'll just waste your money.
You can have the best pitch in the world. And we all know when we're like pitching the dream or when we're pitching what we feel pretty confident that we've proven through process and that we're now just going to do it at scale. Those are two different things. And so being really careful about, and maybe you need to say like, we are going to take this money in order to learn more. That's okay. Yes. But if you say we're taking this money because we're going to be able to triple next year and there isn't like actual factual examples in your company of how that could really happen, you're going to hate your life.
Right. And you're going to have the wrong expectations with your investors.
Yeah. And that puts everybody in the worst situation. So I think like bootstrap as long as you can until such time that you feel really sure that this is the thing that people are ripping out of your hands.
Cool. That's great. That's good advice. Very good advice. Okay. Myth number four.
I do meet a lot of founders and I think, you know, forward facing, everybody's like, my business is amazing. We're doing this. We're doing that. Look at me. Like, here's our photo. And like, but then there is, you know, the responsibility of leading people, of, you know, keeping the company afloat, of having all the answers, you know? Mm. And I think founders have an actual disease where they feel like they have to do it by themselves. It is me and I've got to figure it out. And if I can figure everything out and then I have to hold all this in and I have to like, it's, and they just absolutely set themselves up to blow up, burn out, you know, and to make things way harder. Founders, I think because of the way that we are wired, we think that we have to do things the hard way. Like, we are very hard to permeate in terms of when someone gives you really good advice and you, like, it sounds counterintuitive, rather than say, I'm going to test that and see if maybe I'm wrong. We go, nope, I know what I'm doing and I have to know what I'm doing because if I don't, I'll freak out because I've raised this money, you know? And it's like, we just almost can't take our own advice about being able to have a wide view.
Yeah, I think that's so true. It's so true because you're now the public face of this company that you put together and you're, by definition, you're basically always pitching and everywhere you go, right? You're selling the dream, you're selling yourself the dream. Sometimes we can oversell ourselves the dream, maybe a little bit too much. You got to be grounded at some level of reality and stay open. And that's really hard. That's really hard to be in one conversation talking about this amazing opportunity and this where you're going and the dream and the vision. And then another conversation directly after that where someone's like, have you thought about this?
Yeah.
And sending, you know, some and great event mentors and advisors will just land these truth bombs just straight on you and bruise your ego and sort of tear you down a little bit and then kind of reconstruct you into something better, hopefully.
Yeah. And I think there are a few ways to approach it in sort of a counterintuitive way. And the first is, I think founders need co-founders. Not everybody has one, but I think sharing the load is a gift. And so if you can, that is a great way to not always feel like you have to carry the weight of the world on your shoulders. And so I highly recommend that. I think two is being in community with other founders in a really safe like environment to be able to share the pressures that you are, you know, going through. Thinking that you don't need to know that other people are also dealing with this stuff, it makes you feel normal, and you need to feel normal because otherwise you feel like you're a superhero, has to do superhuman things, 100%. And that comes to an end at some point. And so it's important to have that support. And then I think lastly, that like shield that founders wear in not asking for help from anyone then permeates into the DNA of their culture, which means that when you are not able to create a team or an organizational environment where everyone shares the load, where everyone is part of solving the problem, where maybe, and one of the things that we do at Excellent that I love is we tell leaders, the most important thing for you to learn is that you do not A, have all the answers, or B, have to have all the answers. In fact, your organization will work much more harmoniously if you say, I don't have the answer, but that's why we're all here together. That's why we organized as an organization. And so here is what this is. What do you think? This is co-design. And again, this is something that technical founders are really good at. They know what that process is. And we apply that to employee experience design.
I love that.
And I think when you do that, people feel like they're part of the problem. Like they feel like, okay, I can help and I can contribute and I know what's going on. And then the founder feels not only supported by other founders, by their co-founder, but also by their people. It's not like I have to know everything and you guys are in the dark. And that's really what we do at Excellent, is help leaders bring together their people to all be part of the solution.
I love that. I love that so much. I think I'm learning a lot just having this conversation, by the way. Jenny's amazing. If you haven't already figured that out.
Thanks, Paul.
Seriously, you know, I think that really is true, because I think if you feel like you are the one with all the answers, people will just sit there and wait for the answers to come. They won't be part of the
problem. Will too.
And you'll disempower your people. And that's not a good place to be. And I've certainly been in a place like that in my leadership journey, and still on that journey of learning how to be more vulnerable, but just to ask people for help and not try to be the guy that has all the solutions, because that's, you know, why I have really talented people in my team who have to come up with better solutions than me, which kind of hurts my ego a little bit, but it's actually a really, really good thing, right? Because it's like, I've empowered them, they've come up with an amazing solution to a problem, and it's better than what I would have done anyway.
Yes.
So it's just kind of like win.
Yep, exactly.
And I just need to learn that lesson a few more times, but it's a really important one to keep learning.
The precursor is anytime you're saying, what should I, anytime those three things go through your head, like, or what should we, or how should I, the answer is ask your people.
Yeah.
Every time. Right. So every time you're like, what am I, anytime it's I or we, but you mean like what you're going to tell them, like anytime you say, what should I, the answer is ask my people. How freeing, how relaxing.
Yeah, that's great. You can just, even the difference between those two questions, right? Mm-hmm. There's a huge difference between those questions. I love that. We need more co-design. We need more, you know, more experience design principles in our organization.
We know it works.
Yeah, yeah.
But we don't always do it. And I think, especially since joining Excellent, even in our org, like we annoy ourselves because we'll go, but like, how should we do this? And somebody will go, ask our people. You know? And it's like, but it's true. Like no one is, you know, exempt. That is almost always the answer. Almost always.
How might we arrange these coffee cups? Just put them on the beach.
Yes. That is a good example.
That's great. You haven't already taken away something from this conversation, then I think that's a really, really good point to kind of come in for a close on. Jenny, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you again for joining
us. What a good conversation here in Austin,
great.
Texas.
I feel like we could talk about this like pretty much all day. Coming to you from Texas and Austin, there are a lot of people here who need to hear this, and back in New Zealand. And so I'm really hoping this kind of reaches far and wide, actually.
Yeah.
It's a really, really great conversation to be having. So thank you again.
Let's go have some barbecue.
Let's go have some barbecue and some beer. And I think I need to sleep as well. Probably all three of the above. So thank you again.
Yeah.
And we'll see you next time, folks.
This is Upwards, the podcast for security and tech leaders, brought to you by Onwardly. Don't forget to rate and review wherever you get your podcasts, and join us again next time for more on security, startups, and leadership.